Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 9 of the Overthrows podcast. I'm your host, Behram Kazi, who you can find at Def Mango on Twitter. And with me, as always, is Jared Kimber, who you can find absolutely everywhere. We've got Jessica Bell, Rahul, Ahmed, and Swami Nathan Ramesh Sashi in the comments who are saying this is a good time to record. We agree. It just never works out that way. But this time it has.
I mean, me and Behram do not work. It's funny. I've been working with someone recently who was like, who was saying to me, oh, you know, I'm, you know, really trying to work in cricket, but I need office hours. And I was like, there's no office hours working in cricket. It's like whatever day. I've just worked for 16 hours a day for 3 straight days. And it just happens to be that me and Behram are free. And we actually would have recorded earlier, but I had a podcast with David Visa to record. So it's just like when we could fit in anything around all the other stuff that we do. So we would love to record at normal human times, but that is not how
our
lives work.
Maybe after the IPL or something like that, we're able to figure that out.
Don't be silly. Don't, you know that something else will come. After the IPL is the World Cup.
True.
I don't even know when we're going to record during the World Cup. I honestly don't know what hours my life is going to be during the World Cup because there are like early games and then really late games. So am I going to be watching in prime time and then also watching at 3 a.m.? I honestly could not tell you what my life is going to be like on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, we'll figure that out, I suppose, when the time comes. Muki is happy that Behram is recording a pod which isn't at 2 a.m. Yeah, well, enjoy it while it lasts, guys. Anyway, we'll start off by, rounding up the IPL based on whatever we've seen thus far. Let's start with the most recent game. Jared, Gujarat defended 169 in the Narendra Modi Stadium against Mumbai. And Mumbai botched a chase which was more or less in the bag. You know, when Rohit and Dewald Brevis, they were batting out there and at the crease, they were well set. It seemed like, you know, that chase was done and dusted and this game would not go deep. It did go deep. And as a result, you know, Hardik Pandya had a nightmarish homecoming, the Ahmedabad crowd was not kind to him. They booed him incessantly. The former Gujarat captain did not have an easy day at the office.
No, it was a weird game. All the betting markets were just absolutely convinced that Mumbai were massive favourites to start the game. And I was like, are they? Like, Mumbai had a couple of younger, less try players and there were some interesting things out there, but so did Gujarat. In some cases, it was quite interesting from that point of view. But I think it was probably harder to score at the end of the game. In fact, both games on Sunday, I would say that this is one thing that we never talk that much about, which is there are some T20 games where it's very hard to score at the end. And we end up going, oh, Mumbai's choked. I'm not saying they didn't because they were on top in the game. But it is interesting that in both games, in the first innings, we went, oh, that team should have scored more runs and they didn't end up making as many. They've been disappointed. And then in the chases, we sort of said, these teams were completely on top in the chase. Why did they not go ahead and win? I do think sometimes it's as simple as the ball got a little bit soft. But what I really like from a Gujarat point of view is they've stolen this game because they were 10 or 15 under par. And Mumbai were massively in front. I think Mumbai were at about 93% on some of the win predictors, 94%.
At the 12-over mark, when I think both Baby AB and Rohit Sharma were out there batting, the win percentage was like 96 or something. Something in the high 90s.
Yeah.
That's what I remember.
It got to, I know on Betfair, which is probably more accurate than most of the win predictors, they got to 13 to 1, maybe a 14 to 1 around that sort of period. So, real long shot in a 2-horse race at that point. But I do think that happened. But the other thing that I think is worth talking about is that Gujarat is maybe not set up as much to take new ball wickets. But what they do have in Rashid Khan and Mohit Sharma is a really good double act from overs, let's say 13, 12 onwards. There's a lot of pressure that they can put on through those two players. And then Spencer Johnson, that if he can be anywhere near as good as what we have seen him in other leagues, then it means that you have to be so far, you almost have to have already won the game. And that was maybe Mumbai's error, right? They just thought they were so far ahead. They probably felt like they had won the game. But Sai Kishor, they were knocking Sai Kishor around when perhaps thinking back on it, I'm sure they would have had a conversation of, we probably just should have whacked him a couple of times and put pressure back on him. And that probably wins the game. But you know, that combination. And they also would have thought, quite right, that they knocked Spencer Johnson out of the game. You know, first IPL game, absolutely hammered in his first over. He's going to have to come back at the death. We're going to take him down. And they almost did. And then suddenly the Spencer Johnson that a lot of us have been talking about turned up and things were different. But yeah, it's a real bonus. But I wouldn't also, if I was a Mumbai fan, I know there's a lot of Mumbai fans who are like, well, we always lose the first game. I mean, let's put that sort of analysis to the side. But I wouldn't be too disappointed. You know, a lot of their batters got a lot of balls to face, which is a really good start to the season. Dewell Brevis, getting him 38 balls, even if you're disappointed with his innings, really good sign. And they use seven bowlers. I think that if Luke Wood is going to play, they will use him better in the future because they kind of stuffed up his usage. And if he's not going to play because they feel like he couldn't handle the pressure in that other death over, they've also learned something. So I think in many different ways, it was a good game for Mumbai. It's just not going to feel that way because they were, what did you say it was, 97%, 98% chance of winning. Yeah, I get that.
You know, there were some strange decisions in this game. I know Hardik got booed a lot and the crowd actually even indulged in some really crass chants, which I personally do not endorse. But I mean, that sort of stuff was expected because of the way he left Gujarat and all of that, you know, context that had built up. So I'm not surprised.
And then he lost as well. So like, you know, like he's left them for another team and then gone and lost the grudge match to begin with. I actually think that from this is where leagues like the IPL need to be more mature. If that was an NBA thing, that would have been the biggest talking point of you know, it probably should have been the opening game, right, of the IPL, of the Hardik Pandya grudge match, right? Like, and should have made a big deal about it. And that's where a lot of these franchise leagues just don't get that sort of sports fan marketing. They understand general marketing and all these sorts of things, but they don't understand that sort of sports fans marketing. You see it in cricket all the time. You're just like, why are you not advertising it as this? This is what it is, right? You know, and we make fun occasionally of Star, of like Bully the Bully campaigns and all those sorts of things. But that is leaning directly into what sports fans are thinking. This was the massive grudge match. And I think, you know, it could have had a bigger deal with that. And clearly the fans were aware of what was happening.
Yeah, no, definitely. The fans did not spare Hardik at all. Even the Mumbai fans would have a bone to pick with him because there were some really weird decisions in this game. You know, he himself came out to bat at number seven, whereas I felt that, you know, Hardik could have come maybe even where Tilak came to bat, because Hardik can play that role, right? Forget coming ahead of Tim David. Like, I think he could have come up the order like way before. And also, Luke Wood got one over in the power play. That's something I didn't understand. And you also mentioned Tilak Varma refused that single.
Not the first over.
Tilak.
Oh, yeah. Tilak Varma in the single was interesting. Well, I mean, just go back to Hardik. He didn't. There's no reason to use Hardik Pandya in the first over. It would make much more sense for him to bowl the second over because you want Luke Wood to swing it, right? And then with the batting order, again, I have no issue with Hardik coming down the order, right? Because I actually think if he's batting at number six, that just shows you how good their batting is. But there were just several times where it would make sense for him to have gone out and batted, whether it be the Dewell Brevis spot, whether it be the Tilak Varma spot, whether it be the Tim David spot. Like all of those different jobs, he would have done very well. For instance, they sent Tim David out knowing that Rashid Khan was still bowling, but still had an over. And then that meant that they got dot balls because of that. So I would say that Hardik Pandya's treatment of himself was the worst in the game, and then probably Luke Wood second and Tim David third. But I'm not, as I said, they were in the game. They still should have won it, realistically. So, you know, you can quibble with things like that. I'm sure there are other bits of Gujarat that we weren't thinking about as much where they made mistakes. You know, I think they probably overbowled Rashid Khan a little. This is going to sound weird now, but looking at how the game actually played out, they probably wasted a couple of early Rashid Khan overs looking for wickets. It was actually their best play wasn't wickets, it turned out. It was dot balls. And so, you know, there was a few mistakes that teams made. And, in the end, we had a cracking game of madness in that last, two overs, where it was funny watching the betting markets and the match predictors. It would be like, this team's favorite. No, this team's favorite from ball to ball. And it was just no one had any idea what was happening after having a team who was massively in front for the whole game.
Yeah, that over in which Tilak refused the singles, that Rashid Khan over went for 3 runs, just to put things into context. But like you mentioned making mistakes. Like I tweeted this, that you can't drop Rohit Sharma twice and still expect to beat his team. And they beat his team. You know, and you've got to credit their spin duo, right? Sai Kishore, 1 for 24 in his four overs. Rashid Khan, none for 23. And then Mohit Sharma and his cutters. This has become a bit of a, you know, it has developed a bit of a cult following now, him and his slower ones. And I think those 12 overs for Gujarat are crucial because they don't even have Mohammad Shami right now. And Spencer Johnson Cho went for 17 in his first over, but came back strong, right? Took those wickets. So I like the way this bowling attack is shaping up, but I do think Gill can use them better.
No, I think that's fair. I think Gill is, he's a really interesting player, but I think he's still, the difference, I want to see what he's like when he's 27, because I think there's still a freneticness to him. You watch him bat sometimes and you watch him in the field. And I wonder if just a little bit more maturity as he comes in, he might just chill himself out a little bit and think things through. So I do think there's a little bit of frenetic energy that he has at the moment. He's not going to care.
Spare a thought for Jasprit Bumrah. He returned figures of 3 for 14 in four overs. This is the second time in recent history where Bumrah has outperformed everyone and lost the game, right? The first test versus England was another such instance. I think he was complimented really well by Gerald Coetzee as well. You all may know, whoever follow the show, that I'm a big Coetzee fan. And 2 for 27 by him in four overs. Those two guys working in tandem, you know, in the middle overs and the death, I think that could, you know, prove to be a really positive, play by Mumbai in games to come.
There was a bit with the middle overs, right? Middle to later overs, and then obviously into the depth. But there was a play early on to Ridhiman Saha where Ridhiman Saha accidentally hit a four off Jasprit Bumrah. I've never seen anyone accidentally hit a four off the middle of the bat over mid off, but I don't know what he was trying to do, but I'm not sure that's exact. It just sort of happened. And the minute he did it, I was like, that's a bad idea. You shouldn't hit Jasprit Bumrah back over his head. He's not going to be happy with that. And the next two balls were just absolutely incredible. He's next level. And, you know, if there was anything that I would be annoyed about if I was working for Mumbai, it would be that Jasprit Bumrah has a lot of great games. I'm not sure how many 3 for 14 games he gets. And that 3 for 14 should have won that game.
Yeah.
You know, that should have been enough to win that game. And the fact that that didn't, maybe you get three of those games a year. If you're Mumbai, that you pay him all that money to win those three games so that, you know, and all you need to do is split the rest of the games in the year 50-50 and you're okay. So to lose one of those is a bit of pain.
Definitely. I mean, who's to say if he goes on to perform at this level again? I know we'll have a lot of good performances, but 3 for 14 is just different gravy. And that was a yorker from hell to Saha as well. I would use him, you know, if I am to bowl Bumrah one over in the power play, I would go with the first or second over and then kind of preserve him for the death. But I guess, you know, there are multiple ways to go about these things. There's a super chat, Jared. Let's take that one and then move on. Aditya Mani Jha says, "Hi, Jared Bearam. Question, do you feel the impact rule inflates run counts significantly? Will we eventually need different stats pre and post impact rule?" Look, I like it, you know. I think it adds more flexibility to the game and you can either play an extra bowler or an extra batter and you can kind of bring that player in at any break during the game. I don't know why people hate this rule so much. I like it.
Yeah, I mean, the extra stats. I mean, we've had massive changes in T20. They changed the balls, and right? And we know that that completely changed the scoring in the power play for a little while. You know, day games and day-night games are completely different in T20 cricket. Right. So if you want different stats, you'd have different stats for almost everything. And if you're someone like me, that's what you already do. I think for me, what I've noticed is, you know, looking at the win predictors and the betting markets is people aren't quite dialed into the fact that teams are, especially in that second innings, have an extra batter. And I think that's the really important thing to, you know, there was, there was another one of the other chases where might have been the Lucknow chase where you were watching the chase and you know there was that sort of nervousness. And it's like, yeah, but they do actually have an extra batter in, you know, in this lineup. So you, instead of your batting fizzling out at seven, your batting might fizzle out at eight, and then you had Gerald Coetzee and Shams Malani batting at what, 8 and 9 for Mumbai. You know, Chennai is another team that has batting to like, what, 9 and 10, I suppose, at the moment. So, you know, it does change things quite dramatically. when it comes to those sorts of things. So yeah, it is, it's fascinating and it changes things, but you know, I've got no problems with those sorts of things.
Right. Bart's right winger says, help me. I think you meant to say empathize, but what you've said is empathize with Tillich's conscious decision of not taking the single when Tim Davis' job was to slog in the slog overs when Hardik was coming in spin hitter. Look, I get why he would have thought not to take the single, because you don't want to give Tim David the Rashid Khan matchup. But at that point, you're what, playing the second ball of the over. I think you still take that single.
And what is it, Tim David average against leg spin? 7. He's facing the world's best leg spinner. So, I mean, the problem isn't what Tillich Varma did, really. The problem is that Tim David was out there at that stage when they had Hardik Pandya, who plays
leg spin. And he was dropped the previous ball, right? Tim David, if I'm not wrong. Something like that happened. Or maybe it fell in no man's land.
Yes. Was there one that he hit up in the air that was dropped or something? Yeah, I'm trying to remember back to it. So, you know, if that's probably a mistake of Mumbai, where they haven't just factored in that there is a leg spinner with an overlift, right? And so that the mistake isn't really, you know, Tillich and Tim David's. The mistake is, you know, throwing Tim David up a little bit earlier. You know, we've seen this a lot with sort of guys like Darren Sammy, Carlos Brathwaite before, very similar. They can hit pretty much most things, but they can't hit leg spin. They don't know how to face leg spin. And you know, I think Darren Sammy had a strike rate against leg spin of like 70 in T20 cricket at one stage, right? And a very similar average. And Carlos Brathwaite just couldn't bat against it at all. You have to know that. That's your job as a team. And Mumbai is not a stupid team. They hire a lot of people. It did. I think we talked about this. I was doing the Cricket 8 watch along. I did feel that Mumbai were a little bit more vibes-based yesterday. And, you know, maybe that came back to get them. But as I said before, both teams make mistakes all the way through. You end up, what happens is the team that loses is the team that you sort of lump in more on the mistakes. I'm sure if I went through the Gujarat game, I'd be saying, there were many things that I'd be saying, why did they do this? And why did that they do that? So, that's what happens in close games. You end up looking at the team who's lost and pointing out to a couple of things. Truth is, it shouldn't have come down to Tim David, right? Like that, there was no reason for that game to get to
that
point.
Like 90 odd in 10 overs. That game should have been done and dusted way before. But anyway, moving on, Lucknow lost their opening game to Rajasthan away from home. They were chasing 180 odd and they fell 20 runs short. Nicholas Puran was stranded on a 41 ball 64. And a major talking point in this game is, the captain, KL Rahul. It was a bit of a strange innings. He did start off slow, but he does that frequently. Caught up, got to 15-35 deliveries, but ended with 58 of 44. Do you think he was the primary reason why Lucknow lost this game?
I think it's quite interesting. If you look at Sanju Samson and Nicholas Puran, the other two guys who made runs in this, they had similar patterns to what KL Rahul had, which is, they all started, all three of them started a little bit slow. They all then got to a period where they all started whacking it. And then they all got to a period where they all got stuck. So KL is obviously going to get more issue because Puran was not out and Samson made the most runs, right? So obviously KL is the one that sticks out and has the worst figures out of those three. But they all had that same pattern. The problem is, Bairam, that we're here again in another IPL and we're talking about the same thing with KL Rahul. And we are going to talk about it all the way through. And it's not wrong to talk about it, but it's just like, it is the most predictable narrative of all time. And I thought that was, when he caught up, that bit where he did catch up, and he had to go slow today because they lost
that Andre Berger over in which he really caught up, right?
Yeah. And so you start seeing that and you go, great. If this is the new KL Rahul, this is great. He got past the pressure of them losing all those early wickets. And now he's putting pressure back on the opposition. This is exactly what we're looking for. And he swept Ashwin beautifully as well. He put pressure back on Ashwin and he destroyed Andre Berger. And I was like, that is the KL Rahul that I think is, you know, one of the best players in the world. And then we saw the KL Rahul that isn't, right? Which is that he gets stuck a little bit. I do think later on, and I reckon the same thing happened with Sanju Samson and probably with Puran. They were trying to hit the ball very, very hard and they couldn't towards the end. I mean, Rajasthan should have made 210.
Yeah.
Right? Maybe 215. And the reason they didn't was probably not that Sanju Samson was batting crap. It was probably that as it got, as the ball got softer, it sort of was holding more in the wicket. And if you look at the shots that Kyle Rowell was playing, he was through his shot over and over again really, really early. And Puram was a little bit later on as well. And Sanjay Sampson certainly was. And so I do think the wicket played a part in this. The difference is that Puran and Sanjay Sampson had a buffer because they had scored quicker in that middle, in that other period. And that's the issue with Kyle Rowell, right? He's, if something like that happens, he's going to end up with terrible figures and we're all going to be having the same fucking conversation that we always have because he's already slower than those other guys. And I thought there were some really good signs in the way that he went about it. But yeah, ultimately, again, they had got themselves ahead in that game from a position where they probably should never have won that game. But if you're chasing, what was it, 191?
180-odd.
Something like that.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. Whatever it was. I think it was 190.
It was 186. Maybe someone in the comments can tell us.
if you're on that pitch, I kind of instantly said that they just had too many runs, right? Because that bowling lineup is ridiculous. And so if you can you know, push yourself into that kind of level, and then you've got the, what, five, six, is it just five bowls? I think it's just five bowls, isn't it? You know, if you can get to that level, you're already ahead of the game. And so I do think there was massively ahead.
Yeah, fair enough. And I mean, Lucknow didn't really help themselves with all of those dropped catches, but ultimately you've got to doff your hat and give credit to Rajasthan's bowlers, right? The new ball pairing, I really enjoyed. Bolt and Berger got wickets up front and kind of had Lucknow on the back foot from the word go. And then the death bowling by Sandeep Sharma, death bowling specialist who's still around. And Avesh Khan also bowled a terrific over right there at the death. So I think those guys deserve a lot of credit, and all of the criticism that is being hurled at KL Rahul, maybe some of that should be praised for the new ball and death bowling for Rajasthan. I mean, add Ashwin and Yuzi Chahal in the middle overs and you've got a killer bowling lineup.
Yeah, so once they lost those early wickets and they got a little bit after the Nandri Berger stuff, the markets started going back towards their favourite, and the match predictors and the win predictors and everything started going back in their favourite. And I was like, yeah, people haven't taken into account that they're going to have to score nearly two runs a ball off Chahal. And he didn't have the greatest bowling. And I thought, you know, Puran put him off a little bit and everything. But that was the issue. And so they were always slightly behind. Whereas I think if they had Ashwin and any other spinner, you know, I think they might have been in a situation where they probably would have got so far ahead of that game, it would be very hard for them to lose it. But yeah, it's an incredible bowling lineup. Their team is skinny, Rajasthan, but their bowling isn't. It's the all-round option that is the issue, and then the fact that they kind of need so many runs from their top order, you know, certainly their top three. Riyan Parag probably saved them with what he made more runs yesterday than he had doubled his top score from the previous tournament. You know, he looks like he's in form, and obviously made runs in the spat and everything else. But that's something that we're going to have to, you know, keep an eye on. It feels like that Rajasthan team is an injury away from being very, very poor. And there's a few things that can go wrong with them. But if they can get, you know, in that sort of Pakistani style of, you know, 10 runs plus, you know, then they're going to be very hard to beat consistently, just because you've got to then go through their bowlers. You've got to go through Trent Bolt with the new ball. You then got to go through Chahal in the middle. And Sandeep Sharma suddenly looks like one of the best death bowlers.
Yeah, and I mean, let's not forget, they do have Yashasvi Jaiswal and Jos Buttler opening for them. Didn't come off in this game, but they do have that opening pair.
No.
You know?
I reckon any games they win where those two don't make runs is another
bonus. And I mean, Riyan Parag looked really good, even though got a life at 30. But here's a fun factoid for you. Sanju Samson was the top scorer in this game. Rajasthan's captain scored an unbeaten 82 of 52. And in the last five editions of the IPL, he's got a 50-plus score in the first game he's played in the IPL. And one of those scores is also 100. So if there are any betting people out there, next IPL, whenever Rajasthan play their first game, you guys know what to do. Put money on Sanju Samson.
There is a theory. There is a theory that he gets tired through the tournament. And if you look, he quite often gets a lot of scores early on when he's fully fit and he's ready for the tournament. And then during the tournament, he gets tired. I don't know if that's true or not. It could just be dumb luck. But it's something that me and Cheyenne might have a look at for the major site. But yeah, it is quite interesting. Do you want to do the Chennai again? Because we've got a super chat about that one.
Let's start with the super chat. All right, Bluey. Oh, Bluey, the dog. Asks, if you were CSK, would you proactively look to solve the Deshpande issue? Will the lack of an off-spinner hurt them against teams with more lefties? They'll bring in Moeen, I'm guessing, for the lack of the off-spinner?
Yeah.
So they've got Moeen Ali there. And Tikshana is an off-spinner. I know he's not traditionally in the same way. The Deshpande one, they've backed this man, right? And I think they... I haven't talked to Stephen Fleming or anyone from CSK, but I'm sure if I did, they would say, look, Jared, in the games that he's good, he takes a lot of wickets. We know that he's not quite front line. And they have, that because they have so many batting and bowling options available to them at times, they can kind of have a wild card player like that. And it didn't come off the other day. So we were doing the live watch along and Stuart Meeker was in with us. And we kept saying to Stuart Meeker, you were going to see something like you've never seen before because Deshpande, anything could happen. And I said, there are moments of genius. And I think there were like two balls he bowled that were like professional quality. And then there was just a lot of trash. And Stuart Meeker's like, what? And I said, yeah, but the next game, he might take four for 50. And that's the thing with Deshpande. So, you know, anyone who's followed my stuff, I think that if you're going at 10 runs and over, I don't think you can ever be a consistent wicket-taking threat, and eventually the novelty wears off. But that they are betting that Deshpande is always going to be a consistent wicket-taking threat. They're not going to get rid of him.
Oh, yeah, absolutely not. And, I mean, they chase down the target relatively comfortably.
Well, I mean, they might, but but he'll be still in their plans.
I mean, so much is going right for Chennai, not just in this first game, but also since last season. They won the opening fixture quite comfortably. Another positive was Rachin Ravindra in his IPL debut, scored a 15-ball 37, looked really, really good, and was slamming them over fine leg just like he was during the ODI World Cup. And then the Fizz, he took a fourfer and was literally the major highlight for the team in yellow. They look like contenders once again, and that is fairly staple in the IPL year after year, isn't it?
But what is it with CSK? Because he got absolutely humped in those games against Sri Lanka, right? On wickets that should have suited him as much as this pitch did, right? He was going at 10 runs and over, I think, on all three of his games against Sri Lanka. And then he comes back and he takes wickets in the power play, which isn't even a thing that he does. Like, I'm fascinated to see what he... Because I was shocked to see him in the lineup, having watched him play against Sri Lanka. I was like, well, they're not going to start with him. Fizz is out. There is an element of, you know, Mustafizar, Luke Wood, some of these overseas players, Shai Hope, of like, everyone's like, why are they playing? And it's like, have you seen the bench? Some of these teams don't have any fit overseas players at the moment. I've said this before that if, you know, there was a period where teams had like 10 overseas players in their squad. And I actually thought that was much better for cricket because, you know, allowed for you to play a Benny Howe type player for one game or, you know, Samuel Badri. You could keep on the bench just for the games that you wanted. And that actually made a lot more sense. But now teams don't really have that. And with all the injuries that all these overseas players seem to be having, it's just like I wasn't sure Coetzee was completely fit. When he was walking around the field, he didn't look fit. He bowled like he was fit.
He celebrated like he was fit.
He didn't. Yeah, but he didn't always move around. And I think there's an element there. I think there was a couple of overseas players who just had to play. And Mustafizar, again, I'm not sure if he was an automatic selection, for that. I'm not sure that's where I would have, started with where I was thinking for him. So fascinating there. But yeah, you know, Chennai won that game fairly comfortably, realistically. Also,
this was the first game in which we kind of saw the short ball overdose, right? Shivam Dubey was kind of, on the receiving end and he was struggling. And I feel like this is such a good thing for the IPL because it adds, an element of, doubt in the batters' minds, and also it just kind of keeps people on the back foot for a little while longer. The games are going to be more interesting. There's a bit more for it in the bowlers, and already we've seen how much of an impact two bounces in an over has had on the IPL just five games in.
So it's 50% more bounces we're seeing. So we haven't seen 100% more, which I think is interesting. The bowling average of the bounces at the moment is slightly lower than it is in other games. So that's another interesting thing worth factoring in. I haven't looked at the wides yet because I haven't had a chance yet today, but I would assume the wides numbers is up. which would make sense. So there's a few different interesting things there. The Shivam Dubey one was, I think some people said that they bowled too many bounces to Shivam Dubey. Shivam Dubey was like, he clothed about 9 pull shots that on any other day he would have been dismissed on. I had no issue with the way they bowled to Shivam Dubey at all. But it is a very different thing. I think, was it yesterday, Devdutt Padukal and someone else got hit in the head within the space of a couple of
Trent
overs.
Like, him, right?
Players are getting hit. It's a really interesting thing when you think about it, because a lot of younger Indian players are going to come in and just get tested in a way. It might help develop Indian cricket massively, but there's going to be a lot of young players who are going to get hit in the head way more than they ever have in their life when they suddenly get to the IPL. But if you think about it from an entertainment point of view, bounces are great. Sunrisers, when they had Bhuvi and Natarajan, and I can't remember who was batting against them, but I remember thinking, oh, they should bounce him. And then I looked at the two bowlers and go, oh, no, they don't have bowlers who can bowl good bounces. And suddenly you thought to yourself, oh, well, this completely changes the way that these things are going, right? So really, I think the whole thing was really, really fascinating, the multiple different parts of it. So I certainly will be keeping an eye on we will do a video maybe towards the end of the this week on the main channel about it, because I think it's a fascinating new part of it. And it means bounces mean more runs. And they mean more wickets, but they also mean more excitement. It is, and I mean, separate, even a bouncer that doesn't hit anyone is usually, quite often more exciting than, a length ball, right? If we're being honest. That's three wins from a sports entertainment package. So, absolutely. I think it's fantastic. I wouldn't want to be a batter against some of them, but especially if I was from the subcontinent and I come from a pitch that's low bounce and I suddenly have to face, Nandri Berger or Gerald Coetzee or someone like that going at my nonce all the time.
And I mean, of course, it does complicate things for the batters, particularly subcontinent batters who aren't well-equipped versus the short stuff. On average, like en masse, of course, you will find batters who are good hookers and pullers of the ball. But I think it just makes things interesting. Yeah. And I think you make a fantastic point that it will help develop Indian batters more going into the future. So I'm all for it. Love this. And Tinesh Selvaratnam says, no questions. Please continue providing these excellent content. Okay. I mean, if someone sends us a super chat, we're going to have to take it, Tinesh. Anyway,
But thank you for your support, Tinesh.
Thanks for the money. That was a very generous super chat. Anyway, before we take a break, just quickly on RCB, right? Not much to write home about. They've got a new jersey, which I do not like at all. Why mix blue and red, right? When you had that black, gold and red combo going so well. Faf got to a good start, but didn't particularly captain well. A lot of people were not happy with what they saw. And then maybe the only thing that kind of worked for them was the young left-handed batter who also kept wicket later on, Anuj Rawat. He saved face for Royal Challengers Bengaluru with a 25-ball 48. So, the girls have just won their Women's Premier League, but the guys don't seem like they're up to the task.
That wasn't a good start, was it? I mean, they still look like they're a bit of a mess as a team. I think that's probably fair to say at the moment. And I'm trying to think if I have anything like great to add to what they did. I mean, I'll say this: they probably weren't expecting Mustafizer to rip out their top order, right? And the Rajit Patidar, Glenn Maxwell, failures. It's very rare to think of players of that quality are both going to make ducks off what, two balls and one ball or whatever it was. But as you said, Anuj Rawat, I thought, was really, really good. I haven't seen all that much of him. I suppose I'd be happy that Dinesh Kartik still did his job the way that you would want Dinesh Kartik to do his job. The bowling, I didn't have any issue with the short bowling. It might make Cameron Green... I still don't understand Cameron Green's place in their batting order, but it might make Cameron Green a more important bowler in the IPL, right? Because he can bowl those bounces. So, that's a plus, I suppose, in a way that I wasn't quite sure. But you look at Khan Sharma, Mayank Daggar, Yash Dial. It's not... They're going to have to make a lot of runs. And again, as I said, any team... No matter how good you are, can have one day where your top order is ripped out and you end up with that collapse. And they recovered okay from that, but they didn't recover enough to come back and win the game, perhaps. And I don't think they used their super sub at that stage, did they?
Can't quite recall.
I'm just trying to have a look at the score. So what were they? They were 77 for four and 78 for five in 11.4 overs. Maybe if there was anything else they could have done, it would have been to bring in an impact sub at that point. And then said, and then allowed for the ability to maybe Dinesh Karthik could have pushed a little bit harder, and you know, got, and you know, maybe they get an extra 10 or 15 runs, but they lose a bowler, so it does go.
Yeah,
both
and
ways.
I mean, that is one positive for them, that after losing their entire top order, they did kind of get to a 170 odd score, and both Rawat and Karthik did well for them to recover over there. But good luck bowling with that bowling attack at the Chinnaswamy. That's all I'll say. And on that note, let's take a short break. We'll be back with more IPL stuff. You're watching Overthrows with Behram and Jared. Stay tuned. We'll be back after this ad. Welcome back to Overthrows. You guys are with Behram and Jared. And it's time to talk about what has been arguably the game of this IPL season, Jared, thus far. KKR defeated the Sunrisers in a last ball thriller at Eden Gardens. And young pacer Harshit Rana, he ended with figures of 3 for 33 in 4 overs. But more importantly, he defended 13 runs in the final over versus a red-hot Heinrich Klassen. He nailed his slow ones. He also kind of blew some flying kisses and all of that stuff, which Sunny G wasn't a fan of. He helped Kolkata land a crucial win at home. And, I mean, that's as exciting as T20 cricket gets, really.
It was a ridiculous game, wasn't it? When Andre Russell starts, the game's 50-50. And then when he finishes, it's obviously massively in Kolkata's favour. When Heinrich Klassen comes into bat, the game is pretty much over. And then he comes, brings it back to where they're massive favourites and probably should have won at the end. This is a coin toss game. So I don't think either side should be massively disappointed with how that went. There may be some questions for individual bowlers. The Harshit Rana, I thought he bowled really well with a new ball. Held his own. Was it the two big slower balls at the end? One to Pat Cummins and another one to Heinrich Klassen. I thought we're just... It's funny. Death bowling is sort of... goes through these different phases of different balls being successful at different times. We're definitely in an era now where having a great slow ball is the best skill to have. But when you're in a death over and, you know, you've been bowling with a new ball and you just come back, the ability to land the slower ball and be confident enough to bowl it multiple times is a really, really impressive skill to have. It was just a classic game. And we saw probably the two most informed T20 batters in the world go head to head, and we saw a 200 run game that came down to the last ball. Like, you can't ask for anything more than that. It was a fantastic game all the way through, and really enjoyed it.
And I mean
it.
That catch that Suya Sharma took to dismiss Heinrich Klassen, and I think that is also something very important that needs to be spoken about more, because it was quite hard and it was like in a crunch moment. But just on Heinrich Klassen, right, scored his 50 off 25 deliveries. Came in to bat when the pressure was immense, right? The Sunrisers were down and out at that point. And he scored 8 sixes in this innings without hitting a single 4. That too is an IPL record. No other batter has hit that many sixes without scoring a single 4. And he ended with 63 of 29, agonizingly close to, you know, taking his team across the line. Only to be labeled as a choker by ignorant cricket fans. Now, how unfortunate is that?
It's just people don't understand
anything. It's the convenient narrative, right? A South African fails to chase in a game which was done, and he is the reason why his team was still in it, and now he's a choker. Like, I don't get that. Mumbai choked. That was a choke. You can call that a choke, right?
He scored double the amount of runs of anyone else in that game. He's the only reason that that game was even still around. So let's say he comes in and he makes 18 off 12 balls, right? So he's not a choker, but they would have lost by more. Like, it just, that stuff doesn't make any sense at all. It was really interesting watching especially the betting markets. There was a guy in, this is on the Betfair. So this is the English betting market, right? So I think there was 140 million pounds bets on the English bet, well, on one market, right? Just the Betfair trading market. And there was a guy who put 17 million pounds onto Sunrisers all the way through that innings. He kept backing the Sunrisers. Do you know why he kept doing that? Because he knew Heinrich Klassen hadn't come in yet, and the Heinrich Klassen was about to come in. And he's done his dough in the end. But to be fair, I mean, 17 million pounds between friends, right? But the point being is that, like, that is how much people believe in Heinrich Klassen, that they were, what would they have got to? Like a 98% chance of, it was almost, that game was out. I think it was, 98% chance of winning for Kolkata. And this guy is still backing Heinrich Klassen. That just tells you what he is as a player at that point. Absolutely incredible. Look, he didn't get over the line. I mean, MS Dhoni didn't always hit the winning runs. Kieran Pollard didn't always hit the winning runs. Michael Bevan didn't always hit the winning runs. It's that whole, it was that Michael Jordan ad where he said, I've missed the game winning shot 45 times. Right? Like, I think in our brains, we're like, MS Dhoni won every game that he took to the death. No, he didn't.
Yeah.
He won more than he lost, and that's all you can do. And Heinrich Klassen, I think the only other person in the world that I would have backed to be able to bring a team back in at that stage was the guy on the other side who made the runs in the first innings. I just don't think anyone else would have been able to put that much pressure in so many different ways on the bowling team, to which the minute he started hitting sixes, they looked like they were the underdogs, while they were still like a 90% chance of winning.
Yeah, and I mean, it was crazy, right? I don't think there are many power hitters going around these days, especially, you know, in T20 cricket, as destructive as Heinrich Klassen. He proved that day. And, you know, a choke by definition is when a team which is in a winning position, you know, goes on to lose that game. Sunrisers were never in a winning position. Even in the last three overs, they needed 60 runs. And then first Klassen took apart Chakravarti. And then Mitchell Starc, 24 crores, went for 26 runs, right? Two more runs than the amount of crores he was sold for. By the way, props to Shehbaz Ahmed as well. His 5-ball 16 was also crucial in this.
Yeah, fantastic. It was
as good a cameo as you could ask for. I think ultimately when you look at this game, it's the bowling that kind of let the Sunrisers down, right? Apart from Natarajan, who ended with 3 for 32 in his 4 overs, everyone more or less shat the bed. And I mean, I feel like they really need to make room for Wanindu Hasaranga in this bowling attack. Otherwise, it's just not good enough.
Yeah, but he's suspended, isn't he?
Is he from the IPL as well?
Yes.
Okay.
So he tried to cheat the system. I think what he tried to do was unretire from Test cricket.
Uncovered.
So his suspension would be for tests, and then he could be on playing the T20s. And then I think the ICC went, whoa, you can't do that. That's not right. From my understanding, that's what happened. Anyway, it's a fantastic, hilarious little story. But yeah, there's the issue here is still probably Pat Cummins, who I thought bowled well, to be fair. I don't think he was, I can't remember what his total figures were.
I think one for 32 or something like that.
Yeah, and he was used perfectly. If you're going to use Pat Cummins, that's how you use him. One over in the power play is the absolute maximum. Get him to bowl in the middle, especially now with the 2-bouncer rule. Get him to bowl in the middle, and then get him to finish his overs before the hard part of the death. I mean, you could argue that you shouldn't be paying all that money for a guy who's a seam bowler who just bowls in the middle, but that's a different conversation we had. Also, I think that Pat Cummins put himself down too low in the order, you know, at the end when they needed sixes to be hit. Slight issues with all that. But Hasaranga has to come into this side, and that's going to cause other issues, of course, but that's just what they have to do. We just got one on from Bluey, who says, "Will home pitches like the last one hamper CSK?" I thought the same thing, Bluey. I thought it was really interesting that the team who is most set up to bowl and face spin suddenly had an incredible deck for fast bowlers. I do wonder how much this 2-bouncer thing is playing a part in some of these new decks, because we saw a lot of pace and carry and a lot of pitches here. And I also wondered if this is just a thing that maybe sometimes happens more towards the start of the season, where the wickets are just a little bit, you know, harder and faster. And then as the tournament goes on, the spinners will dominate. So I'm keeping an eye on it, Bluey, but I'm not you know, massively interested in it at the moment.
All right, just to end on Kolkata, then a good result for them. Phil Salt, who finally did get a gig in the IPL, good for him. He scored a 50 up top. I thought Ramandeep was really batting well in the middle. He hit really well. Yeah. And then Andre Russell, 20 ball, 50. I think out of all the half centuries we've seen thus far in this IPL, his stands out. He finished on 64 of 25. And, you know, their batting definitely looks the part. It's deep as well. And then Sunil Narayan, he delivered figures of 1 for 19 in his four overs, was splendid.
Do you want to talk about his batting?
Narayan's batting?
What do you want to know what his batting average is this year?
What is it, his batting average this year?
4.2.
All right, then. But at least...
And they decided to open with him. It's... Like, I get it if he's in form, but he just made no runs in the BPL, I think, recently opening the batting. That was one of the more bizarre things that I've ever seen. Because you always... I was saying this because I think my friend Gaurav is the... analyst for Sunrisers, and I saw him come up, and I was like, oh yeah, of course. And then I thought, I put my analyst sort of brain on for a minute, and I thought to myself, even if I thought Sunil Narayan was a chance of opening, having watched him in the BPL, there's no way I would have passed that information on to anyone. And then he comes out to open, and it's like, it would have been fascinating to see what the conversations were after that. But no, look, he bowled brilliantly. You know, that he probably, there was an LBW could have got.
They didn't review that one.
That he should have, I don't know why.
I think that was against Rahul Tripathi, who was playing a shocker, right? Run a ball 20, was really jittery as well. I don't know what was going on with him over there, but.
Yeah, I love Rahul Tripathi, but that wasn't one of his better innings, was it? But either way, so I thought that was very, very interesting, little period there. From that perspective, and I thought he was fantastic though, Sunil Narayan. I loved the way he bowled, and his figures in this particular game are certainly otherworldly.
I mean, it's a game in which both teams scored 200 and Narayan has 1 for 19, but I think Kolkata are still in good stead because, you know, Russell got that 64 or 25. They've got runs throughout that batting card with Salt and Ramandeep, and they still won this game despite dropping 4 catches. I think that is one of the major takeaways over here, and it augurs well for them. But let's come on to Punjab versus Delhi then. And before we talk about this game, Bairstow comically run out once again, and Mitch Marsh having a friendly dig at him in the direct aftermath. That was really funny.
Yeah, I mean, that's maybe the highlight of this whole game. It was like, my God, this is so dreary. It's funny, because when you commentate, right, you have to kind of talk the game up a little bit. You can be honest and say, not the highest quality. You know, Simon Dool does that sometimes. Not the highest quality game, this one. You know, and you do that when you commentate. But because I'm doing a live watch along, and our watch along is not, it's about people who are going to be watching the game anyway and are either trying to bet or work out fantasy stuff or understand analysis and all that sort of stuff. I was studs in on this game. It was pathetic quality. When Shai Hope came out to bat first drop, I was just like, what are we doing here? And then, you know, put Ricky By and Tristan Stubbs, like, just completely stopped the innings. Sumit Kumar as well. Like, and Abhishek Porol, I give him credit. You know, but the bowling, you know, Sam Curran bowls one over and then we don't see him anymore.
I mean, what is up over there? Sam Curran was the hero for Punjab. Yes, got dropped, you know, mid-innings or something like that. Ended up with 63 or 47, but... You know, sure, you've done your job with the bat, but you're coming at like number 4. You're bowling one over in the entire game. What sort of all-rounder is he now exactly? Can someone fill me in?
I don't know. But also, it was a bizarre innings because he kind of came in and it looked like his job was to score quickly, right? And then he didn't. He didn't score quickly at all. And in the end, it was, you know, the innings that got them over the line. But that was as much to do with the fact of just how terrible... kind of, you know, the bowling was. And Ishant Sharma getting injured certainly didn't help. Kuldeep Yadav was kind of, I thought he was their last hope. It just looked messy. Rob Barron over at Cricket 8 said that, so before the tournament, he thought Delhi was the best bet for last place. Not that he thought they were the most likely team to get the last place, but the people were sleeping on how bad they might be. They might not be sleeping on that. You might not be able to get those good odds anymore. It did feel to me, and there's a long way to go, and there's a lot of good players in both these sides, but it did feel to me at times we were watching the two worst sides, and they were, and too many players were out of form, and too many players were being used in positions that didn't quite suit them, and the whole shy hope nature of it. It was a bit of a miserable game. I mean, of the five games, it was the only one where I was like, can we just simulate this one? And we can get to more serious stuff. That one drains me a little bit. So, you know, you're not going to get much good analysis out of me other than the fact that it's nice that these two teams are allowed to play cricket against
each
other.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it literally felt like whoever will play this one worse will lose. Like, both of those teams weren't particularly doing well. Delhi dropped catch after catch after catch, right? And Ishant Sharma got injured after bowling two overs, which is a blow because they were a bowler short.
And it's a blow, but it's also not a blow because I'm not sure that doesn't strengthen them, you know, because I'm not sure he's a very good T20 bowler anymore. But at the same time, I don't know if they have anyone to replace him. So it's like, and in this game, it was a blow. It was just,
a lot of people were also upset that Prithvi Shaw didn't play this game.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably where my annoyance started. Like, if you've got someone of his talent, just give him three or four games. And if it doesn't work, you move on forever. So I think for me, I haven't done this, but if I was doing stock up and stock down, like, even though one team won this game and the other one didn't, I still think I would have them both stock down after this game. You might look at Mumbai or Sunrisers and have them above, just because watching the quality of the cricket that those two teams played compared to this, it looked very different. But great to see Kuldeep doing quite well. And Abhishek Poril, as I said, I loved the way that he went about it. So there was a couple of Harpreet Bumrah. It does tell you how weird this game is, though, that they were so worried about matchups that he's bowled three overs and gone for 14 runs. And it's like, you had a lot of real rank bowlers bowling more overs than him.
Sam Curran ruined it for him, right? Yeah. He bowled Harpreet's last over. One for 14 were fantastic figures. But I think Delhi should take those silver linings of Kuldeep's 2 for 20 in his four overs and Abhishek Poril impact sub. I think that was the highest strike rate for an innings which lasted 10 balls or something like that. I remember some sort of stat of the sort being shared, but 32 of 10 for him. So not a good start for the Capitals, but at least a couple of performances which will encourage them. All right, let's take a short break. We have some other international fixtures to talk about. You guys are watching Overthrows with Jared and Bairam, and we'll be back after this ad. Welcome back to Overthrows. You guys are with Jared and Bairam, and I was just sifting through the comments, and someone has mentioned how Simon Dhule on Crick Buzz alleged that Sunil Narayan was chucking once again back to his old action. So there's that. And that happened. And then Rishabh Pant looks leaner than before. Yeah, I agree. I picked up on that as well.
Yeah, I thought he looked incredible. And also, you know, batting, he did look a little rusty, but his wicket-keeping was sharp as anything. So very good signs for Delhi for that. And they're going to need
it. He played a cover drive for four, and I remember someone tweeted that Rishabh Pant is driving well or something along those lines. So that was a bit funny. Anyway, we have a super chat. So let's take that one before we move on to Bangladesh versus Sri Lanka. Anish has sent this one. And he has asked me that he keeps hearing that Pakistan has a lot of talent, but then they've brought two retired players back. What's next? Malik making a comeback? Don't say that. Don't manifest Shoaib Malik coming back into the team. Imad Wasim made sense to bring him back because he was in crazy form. Pakistan don't have a spinner. He provides depth with the bat as well.
I was about to say, when we talk about Pakistan having a lot of talent, no one has said that about the spin bowling.
So he kind of, just took a fifer in the PSL final and has scored crucial mature runs. So I understand bringing him back. Amir, I'm not so sure about, because look, you have Shaheen and Naseem with the new ball, and then Imad Wasim also bowls in the power play. So if Amir is just there on the bench as, you know, backup for Shaheen, I get it, but I don't see him playing in tandem with Shaheen and Naseem. That doesn't work out well in my brain. A lot of people will say that, Amir was great with the old ball compared to before he was, but he's not a death bowler, right? You have to understand this. So that's my two cents on it. But yeah, a lot of people have been making jokes that who's next? Shahid Afridi, is he going to come back? Wasim Akram? I think it's all funny. And Pakistan cricket is a spectacle, and we'll talk about it on Uncovered. Just wait for it. Anyway, Bangladesh versus Sri Lanka. Now, first test match in Sylhet, Sri Lanka have thumped Bangladesh by 328 runs, with all 20 Bangladeshi wickets falling to pace. Kasun Rajata took 8, Vishwa Fernando took 7 and Lahiro Kumara took 5. And this is the first time since 1986 that Sri Lankan pacers have achieved this feat, Jared. That definitely deserves some praise.
It's incredible, isn't it? It's such a bizarre situation. I was following that game and it was, I thought when they got to, I think they were about 200 in front, 5 wickets down, which obviously we now know what happened after that. But I always think at that stage, if Sri Lanka get rolled for 220 here, this could be a classic, right? You know, both teams really, really in this game. And Sri Lanka, you know, managed to go through there. But the fact that, I think it really shows how much Sri Lankan fast bowling has developed in the last couple of years. And, you know, we've talked about it so much on this show some of their bowl, and this doesn't include guys like Patharana and Tushara and Matashankar, and yet it's still the seamers who are doing a great job. And they really do have 7 or 8 kind of high quality fast bowlers available to them. And one of their biggest issues has just been getting them on the field fit all together at one time. So I think it's a fantastic an achievement for their seamers. But I'm not. I'm surprised they took all 20 wickets, but I'm not overly surprised at everything that went on here, just because we've been watching them bowl very, very well for a long time.
And now Aqib Javed will be with them in the T20 World Cup. So let's see if that fast bowling goes up or down. But I'm chuffed for.
He might claim this one.
But yeah. I think Vishwa is a really good left-arm seamer. I've seen him do well. Kasun Rajatha kind of goes under the radar. I think he's a better bowler than people think he is. And Lahiro Kumara is a good enforcer.
I think Rajata is just one of, you know, if he would have been fit throughout the majority of his career, I think he would have been a much better bowler. I think we know how good he can be. And then, you know, Lahiro Kumara, he's kind of the, you know, he's fast, right? Like, you know, he has genuine skills. None of these guys have great test records. I would say maybe Vishwa would average under 30 off the top of my head. Although, to be fair, I always have to remember with Sri Lankan seamers that their records are almost completely ruined by bowling at home a lot of the times. You know, you need to be like a Jaminder Vaas level of swing bowler. If you're a seamer or a quick, it's not as ideal bowling in Sri Lankan conditions. But I think we know that all of those bowlers are probably should be averaging between 28 and 32 in test cricket. You know, with their skill level. And as I said, there's what, 3 or 4, maybe even 5 other options out there that they have. There really is, it's come up sort of from nowhere of, you know, Saranga Lakmal on his own, looking around, wondering if anyone else is going to bowl with him, to suddenly that they have that unit mentality at the moment. And this should give them a lot of confidence, right? You know, no one was expecting them to go to Bangladesh and do so well.
I mean, definitely one big positive for them is, like, if they aren't over-reliant on Prabhat Jayasurya in test cricket, then that's a major win, right? Anyway, another record was broken by Sri Lanka in this test match, this time with the bat. Captain Dhananjaya De Silva, along with newcomer Kamindu Mendis, they scored hundreds in both innings in this test match, which is only the third such instance in the history of test cricket. It has been done prior by Azhar Ali and Misbah ul Haq, and also by Ian and Greg Jappel. But what makes this effort even more special is that Sri Lanka were 5 down for 57 in the first innings and 6 down for 126 in the second. And they not only helped them recover from there, but they put Sri Lanka in a position of strength, and those are, you know, hundreds that Sri Lankan fans will remember for a long, long time.
No, there's no doubt that this was a really, really important one. As I said, were they 5? You might be right. They were 6 down with about a 200 run lead in a low scoring game, and I thought to myself, well, I reckon Bangladesh can score about 230 here, and that's where it looked like it was heading, and it went from that to a walloping, right? And that has to come down to these guys. And, you know, Dhananjaya De Silva,
He's come of age, hasn't he?
He's a guy.
He's really come of age, because I think that averaging north of 40 after 53 test matches for someone who is a batting all-rounder and then comes and bats in the lower order, I think, or lower middle order, I think DDS has been a plus cricketer for them for a while now. And now it really seems like he's, you know, hit those peak years.
Yeah, look, I think he's one of the better fielders in the world as well. So you know, you do get so much from him. So I'm just having a look. So what's he played now? You said 53 tests. So I reckon he was averaging about halfway through that. He was averaging 32. So from 2019 through to now, in those last 5 years, he has really played well. He bats at number six. There is, I think if you go back, I think you're right. I think he's hitting those peak batting years. But I also think if you look at his record, there was a lot of him batting at number three. He should not have been batting at number three. Even batting at number five, he struggled. So at number six in 23 test matches, he averages over 50. Now, if you can do that and be a plus fielder, right? Even before we get into your bowling, it's just giving you so many options. And, you know, look, his bowling is like in test level is probably not as good as Joe Root's.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that fair? Yeah. I mean, it's, I don't know. Wait, if I got his average here. Yeah. He averages 58 and his economy is three. So he's not even like giving you low economy, but he can bowl. And you also know that you're going to get seven or eight overs out of him every innings if you need them. And if you don't need them, that's fine. He's still a plus fielder. You want him as number six to be a slightly better bowler, probably. But if you've got a number six, you know, can average north of 40 and can give you anything else at all, that's a huge advantage. And he really has become a fantastic player. Look, everyone will know how obsessed I've always been. You know, with this sort of stuff, you know, he's such an elegant player. I love players who are pluses in all three, or not pluses, but, you know, can give you something in batting and bowling and fielding. I love the way he goes about his cricket, and I hope he gets the respect that he deserves. Cause I really do believe that he's become a much better player. Also, so he averages over 40 in test cricket, as you were saying before. If I'm not mistaken, he averages 39 or 40 away.
Yeah, something like that.
You know, that's more, I would assume that is more than Mahela Jayawardene averages away, right? Now, I could be wrong. It might be more than Mahela Jayawardene averages outside of Asia. But whatever that may be, he bats in an easier spot than Mahela does. I'm not saying he's a better player or anything like that. But what I am saying is that's another huge plus. You are not getting a guy who's averaging 60 at home and averaging 18 away from home. You are getting someone who can legitimately bat in multiple different places for you. I'm a fan. You know that. Everyone knows I've been on the DDS bandwagon for a long time. So I was chuffed that he got an opportunity in a tough test match to show, you know. And the funny thing is, this will go down when people will look at this, be like, oh, he made runs in Asia. But it's like, it wasn't really a normal Asian wicket because their seamers took all the poles. So you know, again, another you know, plus in his book.
I'm a DDS fan as well, and I think I just have a hunch that captaincy might be able to bring the best out of him as well, as we've seen with so many other cricketers. Anish says, forget India versus Pakistan, we want the noggin and stopwatch derby. Well, aren't you getting enough of it already, right? We've been seeing
this goes back to what I was saying before about the whole marketing. Like, if the ICC were a real organization, and they're not, so I'm not having a go at them, but they're just not, right? But if the ICC were a real organization, what would you be promoting at the moment? The IPL's on, great. So you would certainly have some content about the IPL, but you would be flogging the death out of Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, because up until that last partnership, that was a cracking test match. You know, we just had all the nonsense with the celebration that Bangladesh did recently. There's going to be more and more of this. For cricket to be what we want it to be, which is a sport that people don't just follow their own teams and follow globally and everything else, someone has to be like, let's pump up Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and explain to everyone why this is great. Like, you know, we saw even something stupid like the Pak Bean game in the World Cup, and you know, if I was running the ICC, New Zealand, England, keep playing classic test matches. Right, against each other. You've got all these cool little budding things that you could do something with, and cricket's just like oblivious to, you know, maybe we'll change our font on the screen and we'll make it look more like the 100. It's like, oh, I get that. That's going to get people to watch the games, not watching Bangladesh's 12-year-old performance of mocking of Sri Lanka. Like, you know, come on, we can do this. And these teams don't like each other. It's fantastic. You know, Afghanistan and Bangladesh had this incredible rivalry for a few years. Like, people, I don't even think hardcore cricket fans always know about these things.
Yeah, I mean, the Nagin Derby, as it's come to be known, I think there's definitely something you can do with that because the fans definitely are in that entire space. And Andrew Fiddle Fernando did some fun video content on it in the...
Did you call him Fiddle?
Fidel Fernando.
No, I love it. I think he should now be known as Andrew Fiddle Fernando.
I'm fasting, Jared, okay? I'm podding while I'm fasting. Cut me some slack. Andrew Fiddle Fernando did a fun video segment on that Nagin Derby thing as well. Anyway, let's come to Kamindu Mendis, right? Newcomer. He now averages 109 after two test matches. 200s in this test.
He's the Jaiswal of his time.
The Jaiswal of his times. 200s in this test match and a 50 in his debut test. Estelle, you know, told us to make sure that we mention that Kamindu Mendis is a batter who happens to be an ambidextrous bowler. And it's not the other way around, right? But what...
Did he bowl at all in this test? He certainly didn't in the innings I was watching. Yeah. So do you know what his batting average is in first-class cricket? His batting average in first-class cricket is 63.
Whoa. Hello.
I know. And so my question is, so I saw this guy play when he was young. So when he made his debut as a bowler, right, and batting down the order. And in that T20 or one day or whatever it was, when he was bowling right arm and left arm in that same game, that was 2018. So he would have been about 19 at that stage. It's really weird that someone who was averaging this mark in first class cricket has taken that long to get into. Let's be fair here. Not the world's greatest batting lineup. I would love for Estelle to try and explain that to us. Like, where's the dude been? Like, they knew who he was. Like, he's not, you know, everyone knows who he is. So why did it take so long, you know, to get to this section?
He's
with him?
Still just 25 years old, by the way. So he's young. He's still developing. And
he is. But what I mean is, if you're averaging 60 in first class cricket, and who knows, a lot of that might be of the last couple of years or whatever. But they know this isn't a player they didn't know anything about or is in some backwaters. Like, literally, he was already in the team. Yeah. So they knew enough about him. And then he's got this incredible batting average. I'm going to go out on a limb and say there aren't too many people in domestic cricket in Sri Lanka averaging north of 45. And there wouldn't be many averaging north of 55. And there certainly wouldn't be many.
I mean, 60, Kusal Mendis, the other Mendis, is not doing well in the test team, right? So maybe he should have replaced him a while back. And he scored 102 and 164 in this test match, right? That's nearly what? Over 250 runs, 266 runs in the test. The most runs scored by someone batting at number 7 or lower or 6 or lower, something like that. He did break a record, right? So that's...
I think it was 7 or lower because he batted at 8 in one of the innings, didn't he, because of the night watch. So in 2022, he made 1,800 first-class runs at an average of 71. His average the year before was 52. His average the year before was 67. I think 2023, he averaged 34. So he did have one bad year. And maybe that's enough to have slowed him down from getting in the side. But I'm just saying, you know, there's a lot of runs. You know, his record of making hundreds is absolutely, you know, off the charts. And he made his debut in 2022, was it? Because this is his third test,
second
isn't it?
Or second but test. He just played a test match, right? He maybe debuted in limited overs.
No. He played a test match in 2022 against Australia. So that was against Australia, and he made a 50 there as well. So again, I just feel like there's been lots of signs that this guy might be really good at cricket. Having a look at it, and maybe it's because it might actually be because of Dhananjay De Silva, because maybe they see him as a number six as well, and Dhananjay has been doing so well they haven't been able to fit him in, and you know he's not batting at number four, right? He's batting at number seven, so there is that element to it. But having watched him play, having watched the fact that he is ambidextrous and the way he handled that from a young age, like, he's been on my list for a long time of this is someone I want to see when he gets to the top level. And then he does and he plays this incredible test match. I just feel like there's a lot going on with him, and I can't wait to see what happens.
If anyone
next.
From the SLC is watching, like, tell us why you continue to ignore him and the one shit year he has in first class cricket. That's when you decide to give him an opportunity in the test team once again. But anyway, I'm really going to keep a keen eye or close eye on Kamindu Mendis's career, because, you know, right now, you'd have to say sky is the limit, because we don't know where he could end up if he's averaging 65 or whatever in first-class cricket. Just to end up on this segment, Bangladesh were terrible in this test, right? They couldn't kill off Sri Lanka's batting when they had the chance. They couldn't score 200 in either of their batting innings. Litton Das cannot seem to buy a run. Played one of the worst shots ever with 2 days remaining. Just wanted to come out and slog and then fell for another duck. He's been accumulating ducks of late. And barring Mominul Haque's 87 not out in the fourth innings, they had no performances to savour. It was a complete shit show.
Yeah. So Litton Das, I can't remember if he won the most improved player from 2 years ago in our testing, or was very, very high up in the voting. But I know I'm pretty sure he was shortlisted. And so you have a look at his batting average. He averaged 50 in 2021, he averaged 45 in 2022, and 47 only in two tests in 2023. But you look at him in all formats of the game, and that guy just does not seem to exist anymore. He was an IPL player, right? And, you know, he averaged, so in ODIs in 2023, he averaged 26. And he just doesn't look, whatever he got right seems to have just disappeared on him. And I know he's a very hardworking player, and I heard a lot about his fitness and his attention to detail and everything, but it just seems to, something's wrong.
It's that knock versus India in the 2022 T20 World Cup. After that, it's just been all downhill. That was a great knock though.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was kind of peak that, as I said, that period. And he was just hitting, when he was on my most improved list, I reckon he was, 27, 28? He would have been about 27. I was thinking, well, if he's this good now, he should be hitting a peak of 28, 29, 30, 31. He's suddenly already playing like he's 34. Yes. It's like he skips all these peak years and is already on the downward curve. I hope this is just a blip, because he is a fantastic player. But yeah, he just didn't look up to it.
Not at all.
Right? Didn't look interested, as you said. It was just, It was a very, very bad game for their batters. Their bowlers, I think, you know, they would be pretty happy with how their bowlers did for about an innings and a half. Is that fair to say?
Every other and batter then, apart then, from Kamindu Mendis and DDS. I mean, the only other guy who crossed 50 was Karunaratne, right? So apart from those two guys, they had everyone kind of, you know, done for.
So, you know, I wouldn't be massively disappointed with the bowlers, although, you know, you could also make that point that they eventually got flogged a little bit. Naheed Rana, I thought, I've got some serious issues with the way that he plays, because he did get wickets. I think he got 5 or 6 wickets in this test match, right? And he probably might get another test off the back of that. Did you see his economy rate?
No, I didn't.
He went at more than a run of ball in this test match. He's not the reason they lost. As I said, it was the batting. But it'd be really fascinating to see if he gets another test off the back.
Yeah, that will be fascinating. And of course, there is one more test that remains in this series. But we've got some women's cricket stuff to talk about before we wrap up overthrows. Fahima Khatun from Bangladesh, she conceded 29 runs in the final over of the first ODI between Australia and Bangladesh. 28 of those runs were scored by Alana King. And the leg spinner smashed 4 sixes and a 4 to record the most expensive over in the history of women ODIs, which is ridiculous. And commiserations to Fahima Khatun. That's not a record she'd want to have.
No. I'm trying to remember. It was the ODI. They weren't scoring particularly well,
were they? At all. They only got to 200 plus because of Alana. And I mean, Annabelle Sutherland also scored a 50, but Alana was the impact knock.
Because I'm trying to remember what they were when they were, because I was briefly following it. So who else made runs? Yeah, Annabelle made runs as well. So Annabelle Sutherland and Alana King made runs. And so when Ashley Gardner went out, when Georgie Wareham went out, they were 146 for 7. They obviously, and that was in the 40th over. So it wasn't as if they were like, pushing towards the total. It was like they were nudging and nudging and nudging, and then suddenly there was an explosion there. But again, it just shows the depth that the Australian women's team have, and they're multiple ways of being able to beat you, right? Like Alana King is, what, their number nine, and is probably could bat a lot higher for a lot of other teams. And you know, this, she has batting talent. There's no issue there. You know, and then if that's the game, wait, I just want to bring it up. I'll be able to find it here. That's the game where there were three runouts. Did you see? There were three runouts in the top order. So Khatun, Sultana and Khatun. Is that right? No, sorry. Sultana, Khatun and Ritu Moni. So they had, I'm just trying to find it. It's hilarious because I was looking it up the other day. They were, so they're chasing 217, which they shouldn't have been chasing. And they were 70 for two in the 17th over, right? 17th for two. And then they lost. Sohana Mostry got bowled by King. So again, King, really annoying. Then Khatun got run out by, got run out. Then Ritu Moni got run out, and then Sultana got run out. So that was in the 19th, 23rd, and 27th over.
Catastrophic.
Of a chase that they were not on pace, but in the game.
They had a shot.
Right? They were slightly behind the race.
A sniff.
They were in the game. And three runouts. I mean, you know, Pakistan in the 90s, the men's team salute you, right? Like that's ballsy to be able to do that. So ridiculous. Yeah. Anyway, I thought that was a fascinating fascinating little moment.
And I mean, as expected, Australia have taken an unassailable 2-0 lead in that ODI series. And you know, over in New Zealand, England and New Zealand are playing a 5-match T20I series. England are in the lead by a margin of 2-1. Versus the White Ferns, of course, who have recently lost to Pakistan, so aren't in the best of form. And, you know, back-to-back 50s for Heather Knight, as you would expect in the games that they won. And Maya Bouchier scored 71 in the loss. Whereas for New Zealand, Sophie Devine is doing her bits. She's in form. And Susie Bates and Amelia Kerr have also been amongst the runs. Can we expect...
Well, the game they won, New Zealand, didn't they steal that off the last ball?
Yeah, they won by three runs.
Something like that, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, very close to being absolutely obliterated by England.
But can we expect a comeback from the White Ferns? Because they're not in form. England are obviously the better team over here, but they've gotten a victory. And it's not like they don't have good players in that team.
They do. I mean, you look at their lineup, it just... I've probably followed more franchise women's cricket now than I do international, right? Just because, you know, the 100 and the Big Bash and the WPL and all those sorts of things. And then when a World Cup comes, I sort of, you know, look at international cricket a little bit more. You look at New Zealand's team and they have what? Susie Bates, Amelia Kerr, Sophie Devine and Leah Tahuhu?
That's pretty much it, I guess.
If the... 10 years ago, they would have had 7 or 8 players who were probably off that level, right? And it just, I don't know a lot of these women. Like, you know, there's a lot of players in this team that I just don't know much about. Now, that doesn't mean that there could be a lot of younger players coming through who are about to take over and everything else. But these days, we know a lot, you know, we know a lot more about women's cricket than ever before. And you've got one of the founding members of women's cricket, you know, women's cricket being where it is today is New Zealand. And yet these players, it does look like a thin team, at least on paper, someone like me. Someone like Hope, of course,
He's in the comments. He's also mentioned that the second match of the Bangladesh-Australia series was the first time since 1949 that Australia's women's spinners have taken 9 wickets in an international inning. So thank you for that, Hypercost.
Well, it'd be interesting to see what he would think of this New Zealand. Maybe they're building a young core and it's about to explode. But I look at that and look, I'm the world, you know, we're talking about Dhananjaya De Silva, you know, Susie Bates is one of my favorite cricketers of all time. And, you know, love watching her career and everything else. But, you know, she's 36 and, you know, and Leah Tahuhu is probably well into her 30s as well. And Amelia Kerr it feels like the player sort of, you know, pushing that side ahead at the moment. it's I think it's quite concerning. You know, from
yeah,
that
let's
point
see how that series materializes, and we'll take this one final super chat before wrapping up overthrows. Anish says, can India ever come close to Australian international cricket? Well, I mean, trophy cabinet-wise, it's going to take a while. But overall, you'd have to say, aren't they kind of ahead?
Yeah, at the moment, they've been playing better. I mean, if you talk about in the history of the game, look, Australia has a lot of incredible advantages. You know, countries like Australia and South Africa and probably New Zealand are outside lifestyle cultures. They have strong club cricket cultures. So, you know, I was saying before, I just done that podcast with David Wiesa. David Wiesa played for South Africa because of club cricket. And not all countries have that. So he wasn't an under 19 player. He wasn't a good player when he was 20 years old. By his own accounts, he wasn't a professional player or anywhere close. But he got really good playing club cricket when he was 20, 21, 22. So there's a lot of advantages to that system that Australia, South Africa, and New Zealand have, which helps them because they don't have the sort of playing, the sort of amount of players that Bangladesh and Pakistan and India have, right? You know, England's another one. You know, so there are other advantages that the non-Asian teams have over the Asian teams. But the Asian teams eventually, you would assume, especially in India's case, that money and population should win out, right? So what does that mean in the future? Yeah. We don't know, right? We don't even know how big international cricket's going to be in the future as we currently stand. But I'd be shocked if in 30 years' time, India hasn't had a phenomenal run. Whether they have a run worthy of Australia, I just don't know. It was actually quite funny. There was a tweet during the World Cup that like all these Indian fans kept showing me and go, and this guy had pointed out that Australia dominated cricket when South Africa were only picking, a small percentage of their country when they'd come back, when, you know, England were all clowns and didn't know what they were doing, when Indians were malnourished and Pakistan was going through all these different things and Sri Lanka was at war and Australia dominated cricket, you know, and all, it was just slagging up all the other countries. And then, of course, during that World Cup, Australia would go on to win. We have to, at a certain point, admit that there is something about the professional sporting setup of Australia, you know, whether, you know, the men's and women's basketball teams, the, you know, the hockey teams, swimming, you know, athletes.
It's a sporting nation, Australia, right? They give sport a lot of weightage, yeah. Whereas in India, it is a cricket-dominated kind of country. Even though they are rising in other sports, I know India has phenomenal players in badminton. That's something that they're really good at.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. But in India, being a professional athlete was not, it's starting to become a thing, but it isn't a thing naturally, right? Whereas in Australia, being an athlete was always a really important thing. So I did a podcast for Bumble recently because talking to him about the greatest batters of all time. And Bumble was talking about the fact that so many great Australian players would retire at 30 and 31. A lot of them in those days were amateur, but by being great cricketers got them great jobs, right? They would go off and they would work in banks. And I don't mean like a, you know, like bank tellers. I mean like in finance and things like that. And, you know, Don Bradman was given this incredible stockbroking company thing that no one quite understood the legalities of and how he ended up with it and all these sorts of things. And so there is something to be said of Australian cricket's ability to do that. And the fact that it hasn't just done it in cricket, it does it in multiple, you know, football, soccer is not particularly big in Australia. And yet Australia's, you know, look at Australia compared to, you know, many of the other countries in soccer's probably way bigger in South Africa than it is in Australia, right? And there are more people in South Africa that play it. And yet Australia generally
soccer is more popular in India probably than Australia. I live in Pakistan and so there's a lot of fanfare over here. A lot of people follow football, right?
Exactly.
But you look at the Socceroos and the Matildas and look at the levels they achieve.
Hockey. Yeah. Hockey, right? Squash. These are sports that are much bigger in parts of in Asia, and yet Australia is still doing over. And you look at the fact that Australia has won gold medals and medals in the Winter Olympics without
having
really all that much snow. Like, at least New Zealand has snow and has the condition. Australia doesn't even have that. So there is, you have to admit that at a certain point, it is not just the other side of it. Having said all that, I would say Bangladesh is probably the only other country that has ever been as obsessed by cricket as India is, and maybe slightly even ahead of India. Then you have the financial might that's coming into India and where they're becoming as a global player. We don't know where that is going to go. The issue for India might be, but by the time they are undisputedly the best team for like 40 years, international cricket may not exist anymore anyway. And so we might be in a different place. So, but it's a fascinating question. But, you know, looking at why Australia is good at sport, you have to understand that sport just means more to Australians than it does to other cultures. It is, there are two people in Australian society that you can't use their name without going through a very special process. So if you've got a product that you want to use, both of these people are dead. So generally you can slap anyone's name on anything, right? But there are two people that you have to go through. The first one is, and I've forgotten her name, I think it's Mary MacKillop, but she's the Catholic saint, right? So if you want to use her name to like on a lunchbox, right? You have to go to the government and prove that you're doing it the right way or whatever the process is. The other person is Don Bradman. You need to understand how important sport is to Australia on a level, and it has always been, and it isn't just cricket. It is kind of everything.
I mean, cricket isn't even the most popular sport over there. AFL is, right? So there you have it. And it's a cultural shift that I believe needs to happen, not just in India, but in all of South Asia. Because you have these natural athletes coming over there, and sport means a lot to the country as a whole. Whereas over here, it is a bit cricket obsessed, right? And I mean, I don't see that happening, the cultural shift that is, not India becoming a better international cricket team. I think they're already there, but trophy cabinet will take a while, obviously. But I feel like that shift in culture with respect to how sports are viewed and treated, that is decades away, at least. And there needs to be active work.
And it's happening, right? The professionalism is coming through, and there will be different ways of looking at it. But there is a reason why Australia has been in the top five Olympic medals teams, despite the fact no one fucking lives there. It's not an accident that, you know, that happens, right? There are many cultural reasons behind that.
You've got Rod Laver and Leighton Hewitt in tennis as well, right?
Yeah. That's what I mean. You could go through Formula One drivers. You could go through, you know, motorbike riders. You know, there's so many sports that you don't even know about, and you will turn, you know, professional baseballs. Baseball's not even really a thing in Australia, and yet there are Major League Baseballers, all-stars that have come from Australia.
Golden State Warriors guy, the center from Australia.
We're not talking about Andrew Bogut on this podcast. I'm sorry. You are banned from mentioning Andrew Bogut on this podcast. But if you had mentioned Patty Mills, that would have been a completely acceptable Australian basketballer to mention. No, but the point is that it's always, and it's in so many different sports, and it is so... I remember a couple of years ago, I'm watching my wife, you know, in England, they take darts seriously. I don't know why. It's stupid. But English people seem obsessed by darts. And there's an Aussie dominating the darts. And I was like, I didn't even know we did darts in Australia. Like, how does this keep happening, right? At a certain point, you have to understand that there is a different mentality when it comes to sport and where they go. And
what was that tennis player?
I've talked about this before.
Female tennis player who played the Women's Big Bash and won a Grand Slam. Ash Barty. Yeah, there you have it. Played the Big Bash and won a Grand Slam.
The whole thing is ridiculous. And you know, there is, I don't know if there's ever been a great book or documentary about it, but realistically, you know, when Australia went from a very working class country, a farm led country, to a very middle class country, there was a huge boom. So I do think it's a combination of the way that they think about sports and then the professionalization of sports that other countries weren't ready with, and those two things sort of banged into each other at the same time, and you went from occasionally having, you know, Dawn Fraser in the swimming or Rod Laver in the tennis and the cricket team to suddenly having sports that no one even knows about, and you know, Australia's is like, we're really good at yachting. Okay, I never met a person who's yachted in Australia, but you know, good on us, we're good at that too now.
And I mean, this podcast has been dominated by this discourse for the last 15 minutes now, so I think we'll bring Anka Overthrows to a close. Hypocaust did mention that New Zealand are over-reliant on Susie Bates, Sophie Devine and Amelia Kerr. So whoever was following that conversation, they should know that once Devine and Bates retire, well, it might be a bit,
Susie Bates will never retire. Take that out of your mouth.
Yeah, but he's also mentioned that the last time a player other than Devine, Bates or Kerr made a T20i half century for New Zealand women was back in 2018. So, also, Adil Nisar is saying, Parth asked two questions on Super Chat. You guys only answered one. I don't see the other one. I only see one. So I'm sorry, Parth. Maybe it got missed in translation.
I've only got one. He put one super chat in and we answered one super chat. Yeah. That's all we have in our system.
Anyway, thanks everyone who joined us in the comments section. This was an extra long Overthrows podcast. But we enjoyed talking about all those things. And come back next week. We'll be back with another Overthrows podcast. That's all for today. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.